Corporate Action.
Welcome to Covert Action Bulletin, the official radio program and podcast of Covert Action Magazine, where we've been exposing the covert action of the U.S. government and plutocrats worldwide since 1978. I'm Rachel Hu.
And I'm Chris Garaffa, and we're happy to be here with you on Covert Action Bulletin. The Office of the Director of National Intelligence has released its 2023 annual threat assessment, putting China, Russia, Iran, and North Korea directly in the crosshairs of U.S. imperialism and regime change operations. The report is very clear on its motives and the motives of the entire establishment to prevent any other state from challenging U.S. hegemony, or what it calls the rules-based global order. It cites China becoming a global power in its own right as a threat, outlining the Communist Party of China's growing diplomatic and economic relations with the rest of the world, as well as its military might and advances in technology. It calls the Russian invasion of Ukraine a tectonic event. And while the U.S. government continues to send billions of dollars to Ukraine, also admits that the escalation of the conflict to a military confrontation between Russia and the West carries the greater risk, which the world has not faced in decades. It also highlights the Russian government's growing ties with China. The full report is a guidebook not just to the thinking of the imperialist system, but their desire to return to the 1990s, the era of counter-revolution and a global order with the United States alone sitting at the top, increasingly threatened by the possibilities of a multipolar world and the resurgence of progressive and revolutionary politics at home and abroad. They'll stop at nothing, including World War III, to regain that position. That's why it's up to us to not just understand what's happening, but to take action here in the belly of the beast. So we're happy to be joined today to talk about this and a number of other topics by Amanda Yee, the host of the podcast Radio Free. Amanda, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me. It's nice to be back.
Great to have you back. So in this report, China's given 6 pages. Russia has 5. Mm-hmm. Iran has 3. The DPRK has 2, and it's only a 40-page document. So that's like 40% of the whole document is based on analyzing these 4 countries. ISIS and Al-Qaeda get a page between the two of them, and they also managed to like throw in like 1 bullet point for Hezbollah, which I found an interesting choice. Mm. But the focus of the imperialists has certainly changed in the last 20 years since the Iraq war began, but their goals, right, are the same. And it's even more dangerous right now. We've got the U.S. government, you know, saying that it's on a warpath towards great power conflict with China and Russia. And even though, you know, we have all this attention being paid right now towards the Russian invasion of Ukraine, China has always been the real target. And even in this document, the ODNI says, quote, Beijing is not interested in agreements that restrict its plans and will not agree to negotiations that lock in U.S. or Russian advantages. As if like the U.S. has ever actually agreed to anything that's restricted it, as if, you know, pretty much any other country in the world would agree to things that restrict it in the way that the U.S. wants to restrict China. I mean, how are you looking, you know, as we are around the anniversary of the invasion of Iraq in 2003? How are you looking at the way the U.S. is targeting China while much of the media still focuses on Russia?
Yeah, so I read part of this report that you're talking about, particularly the sections that pertain to China. And it's a really interesting look into the mind of like U.S. national security. Because, you know, like nobody really reads these intelligence reports, right? They're not really for the common layperson. Like sometimes corporate media journalists pull quotes from these to support their narrative of like a growing China threat or the narrative or just in general, the pro-war narrative of U.S. foreign policy. But these reports basically serve to justify, you know, they really do only one thing, which is to serve to justify increasing the Pentagon budget, which then justifies more contracts for defense companies, which means delivering more profit to military contractors. So what's remarkable about this report, I thought, was that if you read it, there's like a little bit of like a very thinly shrouded, familiar veneer of U.S. democracy versus Chinese authoritarianism. But if you read the report, it's pretty explicit that what's underlying all of this is that the U.S. just doesn't want China as a competitor. Like the human rights and democracy stuff is kind of shoved in there, but it's very flimsy. And one particular thing that really caught my attention in this report was how it highlighted China's space capabilities as an element of the country's supposed quest for global dominance, right? That really reiterates what previous reports have stated, in that China looks to surpass the US in space capability by the year 2045. And so the US has created this new space threat, which means basically they're trying to expand the defense sector into space. This creates a new market for the military contractors to create new technology for, right? And this was the idea behind the US Space Force, which was created in 2019 under Donald Trump. And I was reading Defense News earlier today, and Defense News is great because it just very clearly, like, nakedly outlines the interests of the defense industry. And it's not like shoved through this framework of human rights and democracy the way that, like, New York Times, Washington Post articles are. But it was saying that in fiscal year 2024, the U.S. Space Force is asking for a $30 billion budget, which is a 13% increase from last year, from fiscal year 2023. So the bulk of the Space Force's request, this budget request, just over $19 billion, would fund development of satellites, ground systems, and enabling technology. So all of this money, like billions and billions of dollars, would all go to military contractors.
Yeah, I'm not surprised. I mean, it might even go right into the pockets of Elon Musk, considering space. It's my immediate brain thought there of just about, you know, how all of these things are so profoundly intertwined. But one of the things I found interesting about the report, Amanda, is just that, like, the way it's written, it's just kind of giving projection. Like, it really is. Like, when you look at it, it's like, wow, like they're saying things like China is using its borders to expand. Or, like, very, I forget the language. I can pull up the language actually now specifically, which I think is kind of crazy to me, about how Beijing is trying to expand its influence and efforts around the globe. And it's kind of just kind mm-hmm. of an irony to me, the idea that, you know, China is using its whole of government tools, is what it says, whole of government tools to demonstrate strength and compel neighbors to acquiesce to its preferences, including land, sea, and air claims. I mean, this is just, I mean, that just speaks volumes, actually, about what the U.S. does. That's baseline of what the U.S. empire does, to use the entire military industrial complex to force the hand of countries and make sure whatever it is that anybody in the world does is in the interest of the United States. And so I just kind of felt that way looking through the report. And I just, that was immediately what jumped out to me. I don't know about you.
Yeah. And you mentioned the U.S. military industrial complex. I've seen more and more articles talking about, like, accusing China of having its own military industrial complex, which is ridiculous, right? Because the term itself, military industrial complex, was coined by Eisenhower, who is an American president who was warning the American people of the American military establishment's growing relationship with the arms industry and how that could influence U.S. foreign policy. So to accuse China of a military industrial complex is 100% classic American projection. And there were also, like, a couple of other passages that really stuck out to me as examples of U.S. projection. And if I could, I want to, like, read them. One said, China is attempting to sow doubts about U.S. leadership, undermine democracy, and extend Beijing's influence, particularly in East Asia and the Western Pacific, which Beijing views as its sphere of influence. Beijing largely concentrates its U.S.-focused influence efforts on shaping U.S. policy and the U.S. public's perception of China in a positive direction, but has shown a willingness to meddle in select election races that involve perceived anti-China politicians. The U.S. is notorious for constantly meddling in other countries' elections, cooing governments that don't toe the U.S. foreign policy line. They have this massive intelligence and media apparatus that has endless funds that can shape public perception in that country. They have these mechanisms of imperialist influence, like the NED, the USAID, which has millions and millions of dollars each year that they can just funnel into these regime change efforts or, you know, these kinds of shaping of civil society through PSYOPs that train people to really support US foreign policy and its objectives. So that was like one passage. And then like another passage, it said, Beijing is intensifying efforts to mold US public discourse, particularly by trying to shape US views of sensitive or core sovereignty issues such as Taiwan, Xinjiang, Tibet, and Hong Kong, and pressure perceived political opponents. As part of efforts to stifle anti-Beijing criticism, the PRC monitors overseas Chinese students for dissident views, mobilizes Chinese student associations to conduct activities on behalf of Beijing, and influences research by US academics and think tank experts. So another classic case of projection on the part of the US, because of course, the US, like in the country itself, it has these think tanks, which are funded by military contractors, which basically shape legislation around US foreign policy and also shape public perception around that US foreign policy. So, you know, these think tanks are a really powerful tool, which are controlled by military contractor money, which, you know, they use to really galvanize support for the US government's pro-war agenda with China in order for these military contractors to sell more weapons.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, there's so much I could say. I know, Chris, you want to get in here. I was just going to say this briefly, just as an aside of something I'm thinking about as you're talking in terms of the projection of the United States. I mean, it kind of takes away the credibility of everything that's even written here. And just immediately on its face, it's like you look at it and it's naming all the specific like points like Xinjiang. It says to me, those are the things that the US mainstream media has been harping on in the last 5 years pretty relentlessly. And if you look at the Chinese media, they have not really reported in the same way on these things. So I'm really confused exactly as to what particular media outlet they're referencing as the idea of shifting American public opinion. Because the truth of it is that what outlets actually have real arm, angle, or ability in the United States to make meaningful impact? I mean, regular people in the US are not even consuming. They're not consuming CGTN. Like they're not consuming these things because they're very hard to get access to anyways, even if you wanted to. And on top of that, we're talking about English. There's a huge language barrier in terms of media and information consumption in the United States compared to China, where of many people, I would say quite a large number of the average people in China are capable and able to take in multiple language sources for their news. So they're actually a lot more informed media consumers than anyone here in the United States. So I just think there's really no particular, you can just kind of dismantle that on its face because you can't even point to specifically which media outlets are what misinformation or what propaganda it is that is being fed here in the United States to everyday people, specifically countering the narrative that we're hearing relentlessly about Xinjiang or the specific narratives that we're hearing about Taiwan. Because like when you think about kind of the vast majority of what people in China feel, we didn't even get to scratch the surface of the kind of content that was being produced in China around Taiwan. Like when Nancy Pelosi visited Taiwan, I'm not kidding you when I say the entire Chinese internet exploded. I mean, the Chinese Communist Party actually had to encourage people to walk back a little bit, like because people were very, very angry. They were very upset. And obviously, actually, within the country, there was an internal shift to recognize that this might get out of control if people are going to like the kind of nationalism that people were feeling might be a little bit too much, actually. And we might need to walk that back because it could be bad for us in the grand scheme of how the international world is looking in at us. And so I just think it's kind of like ludicrous to me, the idea that we are even being, we're not even being remotely impacted by that kind of information, because all of like Douyin, which is Chinese TikTok, I mean, relentlessly about the visit with Nancy Pelosi and the changing of the way people talking about things like the Taiwan province is the way that people started talking about Taiwan on the internet after this whole thing happened to reaffirm that Taiwan is a province of China. So I just think that like even the depth of nuance that we got here around Chinese opinion on Taiwan, we did not even remotely see even a fraction of it, because there are so many opinions on Taiwan, especially amongst young people, younger nationalists, and amongst especially older people who are very much so Taiwan is China. And there's people that have a lot of different kind of views in between to some extent, but not quite the same way that we even imagine it. It's outside of our frame of reference to even understand the kind of nuances of opinion. So I just wanted to throw that out there, that on the face of it, this report is, to me, pretty thoroughly easy to debunk, just because on just that basis alone, we are not in some mass media information campaign about China, because the average person in America could not tell you what the top opinions of people in China are. They're just out of the know. Like nonstop, I think it was for the last month, one of the top stories in China has been what people are discussing in China is the Nord Stream pipeline. It's actually, they've been pretty relentless in talking about the fact that the US, they're like making all these weird claims about like anything that the US is talking about right now, even the East Palestine train derailment. They were saying, and the Chinese, like a lot of people in the Chinese internet were saying, like, oh, well, you know, this is a distraction from the real issue, which is the fact that the US blew up the Nord Stream pipeline. I mean, that was like mainstream media all across China. I mean, we're talking a billion people being engaged in a conversation about the fact that the US blew up this pipeline, or allegedly blew up this pipeline. I'm not going to throw the allegedly in there, but I just, you know, for journalistic standards, I'll do that. But either way, I mean, like that was the top story in China. So we're profoundly out of the loop with the way that information moves there, and profoundly out of the loop with what people there care about. And so I find that ludicrous on its face, but I just wanted to throw that out there.
Well, too, I want to say like it's completely racist, just assessment of Chinese people and Chinese culture, that you can have any kind of authoritarian, you know, government that controls everything that its people think. Right. But, you know, if we really want to talk about like controlling what people think, I mean, just look at media ownership in the US. Look at the influence of the military industrial complex. Look at the influence of just all of these different, you know, industry groups in the US in terms of propaganda that we're seeing. You know, this document came out in January. Well, it was finalized in January and just published. I bet if it had been finalized more recently, we would have at least one mention of TikTok on, you know, in this document, because there's this all out war to say that TikTok is some, you know, Chinese spy app, which is absolutely ridiculous, of course. But I also want to, you know, bring up how in here they talk about climate change and like the US government. As a national security issue, recognizes that climate change is going to affect the U.S. and the rest of the world, right? It can't just be a, you know, an issue that impacts one country. But of course, their interpretation of how to assess this is that it's affecting the geopolitical and strategic interests of the U.S., not that it's going to make billions of people homeless or make them not have access to food or arable land or anything like that. And so they actually say China and India will play critical roles in determining the trajectory of temperature rise. The Pentagon is the biggest polluter in the world. The Pentagon is the one flying drones and planes over more than half the globe with its hundreds of bases, its ships and all of that. And the US government actually wants to blame the growing Chinese and Indian economies, which are catching up very quickly from decades and centuries of oppression and exploitation at the hands of the West, to say that it's China and India that are going to be at fault, you know, as climate change gets worse. So they're so honest here. It's honest to a fault from their own perspective. But again, they do say climate change is an issue. They also, you know, recognize that territory in the Arctic is going to be a concern. As the polar ice cap melts, there's going to be conflict between Russia and the US. And that is also potentially going to involve China, as China, you know, small parts of China, you know, may be close to where these, you know, the melting ice cap is going to be. And so, but they're not talking about how to actually change that. They're talking about how to put the US in a position where it can take advantage of climate change. I mean, this whole thing, you know, we see it every day in the news. We see it everywhere. We see it every time a politician speaks. But just having it laid out like this is it's so disgusting, but also so eye-opening to me.
Yeah, I think what is really remarkable about it is that it just is so very honest in, you know, just laying out how the U.S. sees China as a major global competitor. And it does not want to deal with that, right? You know, back to China's commercial space sector, it's very honest in saying that they don't want the competition in that market. It says in this report, China's commercial space sector is growing quickly and is on pace to become a major global competitor by 2030. Beijing's policies to encourage private investment in space activities have influenced a broad range of firms to enter the commercial market. State-owned enterprises and their subsidiaries will remain the primary players in the Chinese commercial space sector, which also includes research and development spinoffs, established companies, and a growing number of startups. Some commercial space companies will attempt to compete by providing services in niche markets with little or no competition, but they will also continue attempts to undercut the price of Western firms in more competitive markets. So that's really the heart of the matter here, is that these Chinese companies will be competition for Western firms, which exposes what underlies the entire basis of this intelligence report and the entire basis of U.S. foreign policy, which is to protect the dominance of U.S. capitalist interests. And, you know, related to this, in December of 2021, Senator Marco Rubio, he introduced a bill in the Senate. It was called the Space Act, which stands for Space Protection of American Commanded Enterprise. And from its own press release, it said the objective of this legislation was to address the Chinese Communist Party's ongoing effort to replace the United States as the global leader of space industry. So this entire narrative of Chinese authoritarianism versus U.S. democracy, it's very clear that it's just a cover for the U.S. not willing to give up its own hegemony and not willing to have any sort of competition with like non-Western firms.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, a big part of not, I think, in space, but in also all the other industries that we're mentioning, I mean, a big part of this is the recognition from the United States that the inevitability of, frankly, the reality that China as a market, just as an economy, it is the economy and powerhouse of the world. And I think that it's very hard for the U.S. to accept that for so many reasons. And in fact, it's unwilling to accept that reality because China was the economic and frankly, like geopolitical powerhouse of not only of Asia, but even also of Europe, Central Asia, all the way over to Russia. I mean, like the kind of expansion of how historically ancient China grounded the world. I mean, there's a reason for that. It's a major landmass that has all of the different resources that are necessary to sustain life. And on top of that, they also have, of course, this developing economy. They have the opportunity to have like they have 1 billion people in the world. It's like something like 1 in 6 people in the world are Chinese. Like it's crazy. So to me, it's an unnatural way that the U.S. is attempting to intervene at this point, because since colonialism and since China has been able to get on its feet and since the revolution, it's been able to develop at a rapid pace. It's been able to catch up to the West and it will soon surpass the West. I mean, there is just no way around that fact other than the fact that the U.S. has to then increase its own military goals. That's the only way to stop it. I mean, recently, Antony Blinken actually went to go visit with different heads of state in Africa because the arms, the shipment of arms to Africa is actually happening more significantly from China and from Russia than historically from the United States. And of course, the U.S. wants to intervene and change this. But the reality also is that Chinese diplomats, when they visit diplomats in Africa, one, they go and actually visit them in their countries, which is not a thing that the U.S. always does. And two, they bring translators. I mean, they translate materials and bring things over in 7 or 8 different languages. I mean, it really is the way that China approaches dealing with these diplomatic relationships and dealing with negotiating business. It's completely different than the U.S.'s approach, which has been historically to African nations. Well, take it or leave it. There's nobody else. You have to you deal with us or you deal with nobody. I mean, that's been the strong arm way that diplomacy has worked in the African continent with the United States for years. And that is rapidly shifting and changing because now with development, that changes the whole dynamic of geopolitics. But I just wanted to bring that in there because I think as we think about this, the U.S. gearing up for great power confrontation with China, and of course, great power confrontation with Russia, these changing dynamics on the African continent and the changing dynamics around the globe of the development of these economies. This is at the heart of what's happening. And I appreciate, Chris, you bringing into the Arctic conflict, because that is absolutely going to be something that needs to be more on our radar as the polar ice caps melt. I mean, the geopolitical, strategic, military location of the Arctic zone is very important, and we could see major clashes over that as well.
I also want to bring up an important point about, like, you know, the 1.4 billion people in China. That represents a not fully tapped market for U.S. corporate interests. Like, Western capital isn't able to fully penetrate China in the way that it wants to, right? So this is the reason why you have a lot of tech companies like Google, which can't, you know, like, surpass that Chinese firewall. Why they give millions of dollars to think tanks, which create these pro-war narratives around China in the first place. And that's why you see these issues like Taiwan come to the forefront of this kind of like U.S. foreign policy discussion, right? Is because, you know, reunification of China is one of the top priorities of the Chinese government. And the U.S. government realizes that. So they use these issues like Taiwan, like Xinjiang, like Hong Kong as a pressure point to leverage against China. And they would rather see China split up, balkanized into, you know, different competing warring ethno states constantly fighting with each other than, you know, what exists now, which is a rising, very strong Chinese state, which, you know, really controls capital and, you know, doesn't allow the full penetration of Western corporations to exploit it the way that it does to other countries, right?
There's another line in the assessment of China that really stood out to me. And I just want to read this. Beijing worries that bilateral tension, U.S. nuclear modernization, and the PLA's advancing conventional capabilities have increased the likelihood of a U.S. first strike. Well, no wonder they'd be worried about that. The U.S. literally has plans to nuke China, to take over, to establish, you know, a new colony in China. This is not something that Beijing is, you know, worrying about because they're paranoid. It's because it's stated U.S. policy that the U.S. government will not continue to let China be a player on the world stage unless it's a player that is doing what the U.S. wants. And of course, the Chinese government will refuse to do that. But even bringing up first strike capabilities, I mean, we are in really terrifying times. And I want us to not feel hopeless. And I'm hoping our listeners aren't feeling hopeless either, because there is so much that has been happening and that can happen and will continue to happen. I mean, there are anti-imperialist movements, not just in the U.S., but around the world. You know, people from many, many different countries coming together and saying, like, we do not want a world run by the U.S. We do not want a world where the United States gets to send its so-called aid, but it's really its military might, its advisors and its weapons, you know, into every country that doesn't do its bidding. And these movements are actually growing significantly, which is another concern, of course, that the U.S. has as a multipolar world evolves. So there's protests happening on March 18th in Washington, D.C., at the White House, in San Francisco, I believe in the Pacific Northwest and others. But there's also just there have been other protests happening as well locally in other areas of the country and in the world to stand up to this. And that's what I want people to take away from this, right, is that this isn't just something we're going to sit by and analyze and watch. The idea is not just to analyze the world, it's to change it. We actually want to do something about this. You know, at Covert Action, we're about calling out the plutocrats and the bureaucrats and the covert action of the U.S. government, but with a purpose, to actually change the system, to change the fact that this stuff exists in the first place. So I know, Rachel or Amanda, I mean, there's a lot going on here. How are you looking at building, you know, building a resistance to this entire system?
Certainly, Chris. I mean, I think I'll hop in here and say, I think one of the things that's really important to understand, just to break this down, is that the reality of the problem that we're facing, the problem of U.S. empire, it's a problem of capitalism. I mean, the idea of expanding, like, why does the U.S. need to compete with China? Why does the U.S. need to be dominant in the world? And the reason is actually really simple. And it goes back to a little bit of what Amanda was saying earlier about the profits to be made. I mean, the answer really is mega profits. If you control the market, you control the share of the wealth that you get out of that market. And that's what the U.S. wants. It wants absolute and utter domination of the world. And I really think that we can't fool ourselves to imagine that the war machine, the U.S. war machine, is going to stop being hungry and stop wanting to expand. If you want domination because you want to control markets, you will inevitably consistently expand until there is nothing left to take. And then we move into space like we're talking about. So that is the reality of imperialism. And that comes from profit motive, which is fundamentally capitalism. And so I say all this to say that it's really important that we build a movement in the United States that recognizes that all of the problems we have on a day-to-day basis. I mean, the fact that we're paying $6 for eggs, that fact is directly tied to the fact that the U.S. is giving all of this money to prolong the war in Ukraine. I mean, that's immediately tied together. I mean, we're not paying $6 a gallon in gas or $5 a gallon in gas for no reason. I mean, it's absolutely because of the war effort. So the squeeze on us, our everyday lives, it's all part of the same system. It's all part of the same issues. The fact that we are every single year, the rent goes up and the wages stay the same, if not go down. I mean, that is capitalism. That is a system that wants to put profit in corporations first. And that capitalist system is the same one that wants to wage war abroad. And so I think as we think about this, we absolutely can build a movement. And if you're somebody who wants to build a movement and fight back against your boss who's completely screwing you out of your wages and your time, it's the same system that we have to fight that's also making endless war around the world. So that's kind of my immediate thoughts, Chris, about this, that we just to expand our understanding of the way that we experience oppression on a day-to-day basis, whether it's the food that we can put in our mouths, the roofs we can put over our head, or the way we deal with racism or sexism or LGBTQ bigotry. They're all part of the same system that's responsible for endless war. And so that's part of what March 18th is about. It's about building a movement that brings together groups. I mean, it's over 200 different groups now that are involved from all different sectors. People that are part of the Black Alliance for Peace, people that are part of the Green Party. I think a couple of folks from the Green Party have signed on. We've got some really great organizers coming in from the Oahu Water Protectors as well. So, I mean, things that you might feel are kind of disconnected from war. Some of the groups are housing groups and tenant groups. And some of the groups are definitely far more hyper-local women's organizations that we have signed on. And it seems like, well, why? Why? Like, what do all of these groups have in common against the war? And it's the fact that it's your life, my life, and all of our lives at stake if the U.S. continues down this, frankly, deranged, insane path towards nuclear war. It's all of our lives, but also all of our liberation too. And that's why we have to build together a movement that recognizes the entirety of the system that we are facing, and not even just one tiny sliver of it. Endless war is intrinsic to capitalism. And so we have to, for our own liberation on all fronts, we have to fight together. But Amanda, I'd love to hear your thoughts too.
Yeah, I mean, I 100% agree with you that war, the fundamental problem here is capitalism, and war is driven by capitalism, and capitalism is the origin of this U.S. policy of never-ending war, right? Like an astounding figure that I read the other day was that Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin has awarded Raytheon alone, just one military contractor, over $30 billion in military contracts since his induction as Secretary of Defense in January 2021. Raytheon, it's like one of the biggest military contractors, but it's only one in hundreds of military contractors. And so you have these hundreds of military contractors making so much money, windfall profits, due to this U.S. proxy war in Ukraine, and they're making billions of dollars a year. What incentive do they really have to stop this war when they have staggering amounts of money, these defense contractors, that they throw at think tanks to shape legislation and public policy? They throw it at our politicians so that these politicians will vote in favor of pro-war legislation that prolongs the war even longer, even further. So given this system, how can we really expect politicians who are funded by the defense industry to vote in favor of ending this war? It's not in their material interest in order to do that. It's not in the material interest of these defense contractors to do that. So we are like moving very rapidly toward a nuclear confrontation with Russia, another nuclear power, and we are headed toward global catastrophe and really, really fast. You know, because of what's at stake here, we really have to organize, and we have to build an anti-war movement that is powerful enough to even begin to confront this US war machine, this system. And the only way we can do that is by uniting the multinational working class into this powerful anti-war movement that can really stand up to the US government and its pro-war interests. And that's the only way that we could ever hope to confront this military system of death and destruction. So, you know, that's why I think like the rally on March 18th is a really important step in doing that. Obviously, this is not just a one-off event. This event is, you know, part of a series of events where we, you know, all meet each other and build coalitions with each other so that we can really like organize to stand up to this capitalist system, which really prolongs these military conflicts so that a few handful of CEOs can get rich. So, yeah, that's why it's so important. And I hope like listeners will join us on March 18th, 1 p.m. in front of the White House. We're going to rally to say no to U.S. wars. March 18th is really significant because it's the 20th anniversary of the U.S. invasion of Iraq, which resulted in the death of millions of Iraqis, but created tons of profit for U.S. contractors.
Certainly, Amanda. I mean, one of the other things as you're speaking that I'm thinking about is the fact that we have to build an independent movement, a movement independent of the Democrats and independent of the Republicans. And I think it's just such an important point that we really pay attention to that, because right now, like you said, all the politicians, they're bought off by defense contractors, but also they're all saying the same things because they're bought off by defense contractors. I mean, the Democrats were historically supposed to be supposedly the party of peace. That's always what they claim they were. They were the party against war. And you wouldn't even know that if you actually listened to what they say today. These politicians in Congress are mind blowing about how it does blow my mind about how there isn't a massive block within Congress screaming against the war in Ukraine and how this could lead to the mutual devastation of people around the globe. But we don't even hear that voice, which is why we have to be building a movement that is independent, because it's if we get caught up in the he said, she said cycle, which is kind of the way I like to think a little bit about the Democratic Party. I mean, and the Republican Party fighting with each other. If we get caught up in that cycle of you have to vote and that's the solution and all of this, we're going to end up right where we started. And the fight back against the Iraq war was born out of people doing the same thing of saying we have to have an independent movement that expresses another view. And that's the view of the people that want to say no to war. So just one of the things I was thinking about. But I wanted to bring this in here, which kind of it relates in a lot of different ways. But I noticed, I don't know if you saw this story recently, but it's kind of blown my mind about how China has, there's been all these new like articles. Like I read this one, actually, this is on February 28th, 2023. And I was reading this article that was about how America, this is the headline, America must stop China's lethal fentanyl engine. And I'm like, are you serious? Like the lethal fentanyl engine? Like what? This is crazy to me. And of course, so anyways, there's a couple of things I wanted to bring in here about how China's being scapegoated and blamed by the United States for the opioid epidemic, which is crazy because it's literally the fault of the Sackler family. And it's literally the fault of corporations. I mean, the Purdue Pharma in the United States. But there has been a big controversy now saying that because China has something to do with importing fentanyl, that it's their fault for this. And I bring this in to say that like scapegoating is absolutely what the capitalist system does. It's not only scapegoating China, but it's also trying to scapegoat Chinese people here in the US. And one of the things I noticed in this other article that I wanted to bring in from the New York Times was I read this article about which I just was very immediately just annoyed by, actually, because it was just this article that talked the way the headline was formulated was something that really bothered me, because it was just saying that Asians are moving further to the right. That's just what it says. I mean, there's no, we're not differentiating. We're not going into the details of what that exactly means. And most people only read headlines. But there's this kind of belief that even politically, not just Asian people, but other people of color are moving dramatically to the right in this country. And while there's some level of truth in these things, I tend to feel like it's its own type of scapegoating that's happening, where we're trying to throw people of color under the bus to blame them for the right word, the right wing shift in this country. But maybe it's a stretch to connect these things, but I really feel that I've just been noticing a lot of this scapegoating happening.
Yeah, yeah. I think one of the first things that really strike me about these kinds of stories is that, you know, they categorize Asian as, you know, Asian is one big broad category in and of itself. And I read this article that you're talking about in the New York Times, and a lot of the statistics cited were from the Asian American Legal Defense Education Fund. There were like a couple of polls that were cited in this New York Times article, voter polls. And so I looked it up, and it said that, you know, the people surveyed for this poll, they spoke Arabic, Bengali, Chinese, Gujarati, Hindi, Korean, Punjabi, Urdu, and Vietnamese, and maybe like a couple more, which really reflects the broad diversity of people that they group within this one category of Asian, right? And it's a very broad category of different nationalities and also class backgrounds, which is really fundamental to this issue. And also you have to disentangle like these two overlapping categories, right? There are Asian voters and then there are Asian people. And while these surveys do indicate that Asian votership has increased in the past year, which is, you know, has some element of truth in it, there are still structural barriers which make it difficult for a lot of Asian people to do so. Immigrants tend not to vote due to lack in English proficiency, for example, which prevents them from understanding like candidate platforms. There's also like the issue of lack of language interpreters at voting sites. There's the issue of younger people tending not to vote compared to older people. No. I get what you're saying in that these kinds of stories really throw Asian people under the bus. And Asian people have really been the target these last couple of years in light of COVID. You know, we've been targets of harassment within New York City itself. There is, you know, tons of exploitation of the Asian community. Like Asian Americans are the poorest ethnicity in New York City. Chinatown community in New York City, consistently underfunded, never have their interests raised, can't get any money. Currently in Monticello, New York, there are plans to develop a casino, and casinos are notorious for targeting and exploiting Asian elders because, you know, because of capitalism, we don't have any places where people can hang out and go. And so a lot of Asian elders just go out to hang out in casinos. And so casinos love that because there's just like this like source of money for them. So yeah, like this idea of Asian people suddenly shifting right, it really bothers me as well, because it doesn't, there's like a more complex picture here that doesn't quite fit that narrative.
Yeah, definitely, Amanda. I mean, oh my God, just quick aside about the casinos. I mean, they are the most language access places that have the best translations that you will find. I mean, if you go to any casino on the East Coast, all of them have Vietnamese, they have Cambodian, they also have Chinese. This is crazy. We do not have the signs in Chinese in the hospitals. Like what? Like, your hospitals can't handle the level of like actual language access that casinos do. And that should absolutely say something about this system. But I wanted to bring this in here. And Chris, I know I want to have you get in here, too. I brought this up as the idea of scapegoating for a very particular reason. And the reason why is that I feel that they were doing this also with the Latino vote, that the reason why supposedly there's this right wing shift, it's not white supremacy. OK, the reason why everything's going to the right and why the Republicans are winning everything, it's not gerrymandering. It's not the profound racial inequality in this country. It's because of particular groups of voters that are, I guess, just it's a way that they soft legitimize these right wing ideas as well. But they say it's all the fault of Asian people for voting right. It's all the fault of Latino voters because they're the ones who are swinging everything right. And it just comes off in that way where they're throwing people under the bus and they're also soft embracing these right wing ideas by saying that, well, maybe there is something to look at because, you know, these people of color, they like these ideas too. So because they like these ideas too, maybe there's something of grain of truth in there. So it's a really dangerous thing. I think it's profoundly irresponsible. The New York Times has done this before, also with the black vote, claiming that the black vote has gone further right. And it's just all of the framing is to make it so that way the Democratic Party and the liberals who don't want to admit that the real problem, especially specifically for the black vote, the problem is if you look at all the polls and all the stats and you break them down a little bit differently, you'll find that it wasn't that black people are not voting Democrat because they're voting Republican. It's because they're not voting at all because they are either gerrymandered out of their vote and feel disempowered, or they're not voting at all because they have no interest in what the Democrats are putting forward. And so that's the case for black America. And if you take some of these studies and break down a little bit of what the New York Times was saying, you kind of end up in a similar boat. Like, what part of Asian America? Are we talking about older Asian voters who are the vast majority of people who do vote in the Asian community? They're going to be tending older, tending second generation, tending to a very particular subgroup of people. Or are we talking about the young people who also studies have shown overwhelmingly across all races, young people are turning straight socialist? Like, we're not even talking about like a turn a little bit to the left. We're talking a hard turn to socialist politics. That's what the voter polls are showing about young people. So is it young Asian Americans? So I just find that the way that these things are framed are misleading, and they're misleading on purpose. And they're meant to divide our country, which in so many ways in the United States, we are profoundly divided already by racism. And it's about deepening those divides and trying to scapegoat communities and scapegoat people to say, well, you know, maybe Asian people aren't really with the rest of us fighting for racial justice. Because even within this, and this is my last point that I felt this way very strongly when I read this, was that when we see that data about turning to the right, specifically in New York City, a lot of the reason why that is has to do with very particular issues. And it's the issues of the schools. And now that's a very complicated topic to get into. But for a lot of Asian Americans, there's this false framing that we need to get rid of affirmative action because it hurts Asians, in which it does hurt Asian Americans, but not because of affirmative action. It's because of racism, that the schools don't allow in excess amounts of Asian people, and they want to instead bring it down to a smaller quota that is what is the bare minimum in which they're supposed to admit. But the reality is that it's actually not affirmative action that's the problem. It's that these schools are being racist, but it's not being talked about that way. And so many Asian voters, older voters who are very worried about the schools, They turn more to the right because they're being offered an option which says, well, if you vote for us, we'll remove these recommendations for the schools so that way all of your kids can get in, which is also false. That's not going to happen if they get rid of affirmative action. Less Asian people will get into college and into colleges because of that. There isn't going to be some sort of magical race blind casting suddenly that's going to happen or admissions that's going to happen. But it's a separate aside. But my point here is just that the idea that people are turning to the right is also false within New York. People are voting on very specific issues. But if you ask them more overall where they stand, they will surprise you with where they are. But Chris, I know you want to get in here.
I feel like it's like five topics ago, but on the casinos thing, you know, I'm in Connecticut. We have the two, you know, Foxwoods and Mohegan Sun up here. And there's buses from New York City, from Chinatown, like, you know, the Chinatown bus that takes people straight from Chinatown, New York City, right up to one of those or both of those, the casinos up here in Connecticut for the day. And it's such an important point that you raised. And it's happening in the midst of a conversation, too, about, you know, separate from all this, about like, can we blame cell phones for the rise in mental illness or you know, in young people? But it's actually about not having that third place, right? But this also impacts elderly folks. And I'm so glad you brought that into the conversation. On this New York Times article, I mean, there is so much that is wrong with it. Just like statistically, they have, and the article is Asian Americans shifting right. They have this chart, you know, towards the top. It's Asian American votes in national elections. They show from 2004 to 2020, the presidential elections, but then they show the 2022 midterm election. Like, you can't compare those things. Turnout is significantly higher in a presidential election year than it is in a midterm year. In fact, I mean, in 2022, there was like 107 million people across the country who voted. Whereas in 2020, it was almost 160 million people. The other thing I noticed, though, is when you start adding up, they have like the Democrats on the left, like the column with the percentage of how many people, how many Asian Americans voted for Democrats versus the Republicans to the right. 2022 is the first year where the difference, where the total adds up to 96%, not 97 or 98, 99, which also says that there are third party votes happening. And that actually is a national trend. So they don't line that up. If you look at it, you're like, oh, 64%, 32%. Oh, that's only 96%. What's that other 4%? So, I mean, on top of everything else you said, the media is being just so slippery here. But also, I read this article, and this article to me is the New York Times basically saying, yo, Democrats, you're going a little too far to the left. You know, you're getting a little too progressive here. You can't be talking about, you know, trans rights. You can't talk about, you know, race and immigration in the way that you do. That's, I mean, it's explicit, like, in this article. It's basically a warning to the Democratic Party from the New York Times that you're going to lose this other group of voters that you have traditionally relied on, even though you've done nothing for them, if you keep doing these things that the center does not want. And I think, like, we have to look at this article as well, you know, in that context. But Amanda, I know we've had you for a while. We appreciate your time. We'll let you get the last word in here.
I mean, I just want to like end with like a few stats about Asian Americans in New York City. As I said earlier, Asian Americans have the highest poverty rate out of all ethnicities in New York City. 1 in 4 Asian adults live in poverty. And researchers found that 23% of Asian New Yorkers lived in poverty in 2020, and that's comparable to the rate of poverty experienced by Black and Latino New Yorkers. And that's higher than the citywide average of 16% of all New Yorkers. So the poverty rate of Asian New Yorkers who are 65 or older in 2020 was 28% compared to 23% for seniors citywide. Asian American poverty isn't really a problem that a lot of people recognize. And I feel like these sorts of stories about Asian people moving rightward, that really works to obscure this underlying fact of Asian Americans and like the particular issues that they face in New York City and in the United States in general. And it kind of reinforces this myth that's really popular of like East Asian privilege. And, you know, that's like a very common way of looking at the Asian American experience, right? It's basically repackaged model minority myth, which has done immense harm to the Asian American community. And it's also very limited analysis in and of itself. So yeah, that's what I want to say about that.
Definitely, Amanda, couldn't agree more. It's very harmful. And the scapegoating is part of it. It's the same reason why we have the model minority myth. It's like, take a look at them. They think that they're better than you. They think that they have it better than you. We offer better things for them. So then therefore, because of that, you know, you're the one who's not working hard enough. I mean, it's the same idea. And to what you're saying, Chris, I think it's also this weird racism that people believe that, I guess, Asian people or Black people or Latinos are more likely to be homophobic than, I don't know, some of the most conservative people in the country, which are evangelical whites. So I just think it's really crazy to me that when we talk about conservatism, the most conservative people in this country, period, are white people. In terms of subdivisions of within racial groups, the most conservative group in this country of the subdivisions is going to be conservative white people. And that's because many of them outright believe in white supremacist fascism. And so I think that it's just kind of profoundly irresponsible for the New York Times to just talk about these things in this way without that fundamental grounding, which is the country is also shifting predominantly rightwards because of evangelical white groups who are also other groups as well advocating for straight up fascism. So anyways, I'll leave it there. There's a lot more to be said on this topic, but either way, I'm so happy to be joined by Amanda Yee, who is the host of Radio Free Amanda. Thank you for joining us today, Amanda. It was wonderful having you.
Thank you so much.
Well, either way, we're going to have to leave it right there. But before we go, if you like what you heard today and want to support independent journalism, go to patreon.com/covertactionmagazine. That's patreon.com/covertactionmagazine. Become a patron to get early access to content, but really become a patron to support independent journalism and support the show that you heard today. We really appreciate all of the support we get from our patrons. You've been listening to Covert Action Bulletin. I'm Rachel Hu.
And I'm Chris Garaffa. Covert Action Bulletin is the official show of Covert Action Magazine and is brought to you by way of WBAI 99.5 Pacifica Radio in New York. If you missed any of our episodes, you can subscribe to our podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you find podcasts by searching for Covert Action Bulletin or listen on your station's archive. That's all the time we have today. Thanks for listening to Covert Action Bulletin.
Covert Action. Thank you.